Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's seminar. It's my big honor to welcome here our guest, Professor Robert Hicks. This is his second time being with us. Today he's going to talk about environmental issues, environmental economics, environmental policy. And for those of you who haven't met him so far, I will just say a few words at the beginning. So Professor Robert Hicks is Senior Fellow in Political Economy at the Independent Institute and editor of the Institute's quarterly journal, The Independent Review, a journal of political economy. He got his PhD in economics from the Johns Hopkins University and has taught at the University of Washington, Lafayette College, and Seattle University. Currently, he's teaching at the University of Economics here in Prague, where some of you met him. He has edited many books, among others also the book we are going to talk today about, which is Rethinking Green, Alternatives to Environmental Bureaucracy. Unfortunately, we don't have the book today, but it will be available starting Friday when the books arrive to the Prague Conference on Political Economy. So if you are interested, you can check on the website of the Brani Institute and find out what this PCP is and how to get the book. Professor Hicks also authored books, among others, Crisis and Leviathan, Critical Episodes in the Growth of American Government, or Against Leviathan, Government Power and a Free Society. He has appeared in many famous televisions, such as Czech TV, or CBN, ABC, C-SPAN, and many others. Gave interviews to Terra Libera, or Mladá fronta dnes, TIDEN, New York Times, Washington Post, and those. and that's about it. We are very pleased to have him here today, and it's my honor to be here with you. And if you can tell us a few words.
Okay. Thank you, Teresa, and thank all of you for coming out to hear about this book. As Teresa mentioned, I'm the editor of a quarterly journal called The Independent Review, which is a product of a small think tank called the Independent Institute, which is located in California. Although I've worked with the Independent Institute for many years, I don't live in California, and I actually do my work by internet and telephone and other technological means of remaining in contact with the world. I live in a rural area of the state of Louisiana, about 60 kilometers north of the city of New Orleans. So thank goodness for modern technology. It allows me to live the way I prefer. But as I've been editing the Independent Review for 10 years, from time to time I would include an article about some aspect of environmental policy. This is one of the important areas of government policy making that has great effects on the economy and the society in the United States, and one of the major areas of political debate and contention in the United States, as it is in many other places, of course. And I never made a plan as I went along that someday I would bring out a book on environmental policy. It just happened that over the course of 10 years, a great many articles about some aspect of environmental policy had been included in the journal. And About a year ago, some of us decided that a purpose would be served if we collected some of those articles, not every one, but some that would fall into a reasonably coherent a plan of presentation and bring out a book about environmental policy. And this book is the result. It is the work of 20 different authors in addition to the other editor, Carl Close, my colleague at the Independent Institute, and myself. Carl and I wrote only the introduction, so the real experts are the ones that wrote the other chapters, the substantive chapters of the book. And these papers deal with a great variety of specific topics. Most of them have application to the United States, but certainly not all of them. And many of them have some application to the whole world, and not to any specific country. Papers, for example, on population growth or sustainable development, such topics as that. We also have two very nice papers on environmental policy in Africa, and one paper that actually concerns an eco-industrial park in Denmark, in the city of Kalundborg, which is a quite interesting case of arrangements for the use of industrial byproducts and the use of those byproducts as supplies for related industries in a way that turns what would otherwise be pollution or trash into something worthwhile, and also keeps them out of the general environment. So the essays range very widely. The common element tends to be the one expressed in the subtitle of the book, Alternatives to Environmental Bureaucracy, because in some way each of the authors, I think, is an opponent of the kind of environmental policy making that has much in common with central planning. In the United States, we have a Congress that passes legislation, often setting rules that apply throughout the entire country, whether the part of the country is highly urbanized or almost completely rural, or whether it's a hot place or a cool place. And the United States is a vast a country, and so it has many different physical contexts within it and many different economic and social situations as well. And yet, often our national authorities make one set of rules, just as in the old days of central planning, the planners made one set of rules that everybody had to follow. So these authors are at pains to propose alternative ways of carrying out environmental policy that would be more effective. They're certainly not enemies of environmental protection. I would not want you to think that. They're all people who believe that environmental quality is important and that it has value, but they are not persuaded that the existing environmental policies are serving the purpose that people expect them to serve. In fact, many of them identify a kind of pattern, which is that environmental protection measures begin with great expectations, and within usually no more than a few years, they turn into politics as usual, with competing interest groups and government bureaucracies that are more concerned about themselves than about the environment they're supposed to be protecting. So there are some themes. The environmental movement in the United States, which is often identified as beginning in the late 1960s, actually has a long history there. In the late 19th century, many people began to be concerned about the environment, even in places where hardly any human beings were living. They were still worried about some form of protection of the environment, and people such as John Muir in the late 19th century were crusading in a way to make the general public more aware of some of the natural treasures that the country contains, and to be alive to the need for preserving some of them or protecting them from what might harm them. So we have a long movement. It was known in the old days as a conservation movement, and not John Muir, but many of the other early conservationists were not so much concerned with preservation of the environment as with efficient use of the environment. They were not opposed to cutting trees down, but they often believed that public regulation of some kind would be better than allowing private property owners to decide how to use the natural environment. And I think certainly in retrospect almost everyone would agree that the early conservationists were naive. They were naive in their understanding of the political process. They seemed to have believed that once we passed a law or once we created a government agency and put some experts in charge, then the problem would be solved, that we would not have politics messing up the situation as it so often does in any area we care to name. I think in modern times, public choice analysis, which has become reasonably well known, at least among social scientists in the past 30 years, has thrown a brighter light over these forms of regulation. We now know that all actors, whether they are regulators of some part of the environment or lawmakers or general citizens, have their specific incentives and constraints, that no one is simply endowed with a desire to promote the general interest in a way that everyone agrees with. Indeed, all of politics has to do with disagreements of some kind. If we all agreed on how the world should be run, we wouldn't need to fight over it or make laws. We'd just act accordingly. So public choice analysis has alerted us that there's a reason why many of these conservation or environmental protection measures haven't worked the way their early supporters expected them to work. And many of them have become captive of special interests of one kind or another. And what we've seen here is that activities that were created because some form of market failure was supposed to be occurring have given rise to some form of government failure. And it's these kinds of problems that the authors in the book analyze and describe in considerable detail. Let me just give you a few examples of what has happened in a few areas. We had a law passed in 1973 in the United States. It's known as the Endangered Species Act. And the objective of this legislation was to provide government protection and regulation so that certain animal species or plant species that might be in danger of destruction by human activity would be preserved and saved. And I think now everyone, friend or foe of the Endangered Species Act, agrees that it's been more or less a failure. Not everyone agrees on the sense in which it has failed, but we certainly know that it created some very perverse incentives for landowners. Out in the western part of the United States, people have a kind of slogan, the people who own land there, with regard to animal species that are protected by the Endangered Species Act. And the slogan is, shoot, shovel, and shut up, which means if you see one of these creatures on your property, you should immediately kill it, bury it, and say nothing to anyone. Now, the reason people would behave in this perverse way is not that they hate life, but that if the authorities find that your property is harboring a member of an endangered species, then they may actually take virtually complete control of your property and prevent you from doing anything to use it or develop it. That is to say, they may make your property completely lacking in value to you. And so property owners hold their property for a reason. They have expectations as to the use to which they want to put the property, and the risk that someone from the Fish and Wildlife Service will come along and find there's a certain bird or perhaps even an insect or a snail of some kind that's on the endangered list, and then prevent you from ever cutting another tree or making a path or a road or building a house or doing anything on that property, is extremely unsettling to property owners. And most of them just take action to try to ensure that event never occurs. So of course the effect on the protected species is exactly the opposite of the one the legislation is supposed to have. That's just one example. This act has had great administrative costs, and perhaps worst of all, it can't show much result. Hardly ever is any item removed from the list. The government regulators don't seem to have any success in fostering the species they're protecting well enough that some of them thrive and are no longer endangered. Very few have been removed from the endangered list. Another problem is that environmental regulation in the United States has proven to be enormously costly. According to one recent estimate, all environmental regulations have brought about costs of more than $200 billion in the United States for enforcement and compliance actions. So this is an enormous amount of wealth that has been consumed just by seeing that people obey the rules that have been made. If we had some reason to believe that great benefits have come from these rules, we might be content to believe that these costs still make sense. But the evidence does not suggest that such great benefits have been created. The Environmental Protection Agency's regulations have been estimated to have affected manufacturers so much in the United States that the result was that after 20 years of operation, actually less than 20 years, the effect was to cause a reduction in the gross domestic product of the United States of more than 20%. So that around 1990, if these regulations had never existed, we would have had 20% more gross domestic product than we had. Rather than spending money for producing goods and services and for making investments to produce goods and services or making investments in better ways to produce goods and services, manufacturers have been required to take a great variety of actions that are very expensive entirely to satisfy environmental regulations. Probably the best known are the requirements of electrical power generating stations to install special equipment to prevent emissions into the air of especially sulfur and nitrogen oxides. So this has been extremely costly in terms of foregone production in the United States. The precision of these estimates is not the point. I'm sure there could easily be quarreling about whether it's 20% or 15% or 25%, but the order of magnitude is extraordinarily high. Another item has to do with the alarmism over global warming and the Kyoto Protocol that came out of that alarm. I myself believe that the science on this question is still very uncertain. As I do know that in the United States, scientists who dispute the standard story that there is global warming and it's caused by human activity and that it will in the future, perhaps not very far in the future, cause grave problems of various kinds. I do know that scientists who dispute that or question that have been penalized by government agencies that finance scientific research. So that one has a suspicion, more than a little suspicion, that this is a story that serves the ends of governments that want power to regulate more aspect of economic life, and that they're hiring scientists who will present the message they want to hear. I don't know that it's a blatant thing. I'm sure that many of these scientists don't feel that they are being bought. But it may be that the end product is very much the same. And one final example I'll mention has to do with a law that we call Superfund. This was passed in 1980. It has a long, complicated name, Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act. And I have considerable personal experience with this CERCLA, or Superfund law. I've worked as an expert witness on two very large CERCLA cases in the courts. One of them, which was called United States versus ASARCO, was the biggest Superfund case ever to go to trial. Many of these legal proceedings never go to trial because the lawyers on each side draw them out for years and years and years. So the lawyers who work on CERCLA actually speak of it as the Lawyers Relief Act because there's enormous money to be made by those who work for the defendants because they have so much at stake, they're willing to pay a great deal for the best legal representation. And on the other side, the EPA and the U.S. Department of Justice, they have unlimited money for lawyers because the taxpayers cover all of their costs. So both sides have an incentive to keep the legal proceedings going almost indefinitely, and that has generally been what has happened in these Superfund proceedings. Unfortunately, this is basically a terrible law. It is a tyrannical law in many ways, perhaps the worst aspect of it is that it penalizes people for actions that were completely legal at the time they were taken. So it's what is called in law ex post facto legislation. And in addition, its enforcement in the courts involves a doctrine called a joint and several liability, which means that any party that is held to have made any contribution whatever to creating a toxic land site may be held responsible for the entire cost of cleanup. Even if 1,000 parties created the pollution, one party, perhaps the only one remaining as a legal entity, may be held responsible for covering the entire cleanup cost. That was the case in U.S. versus ASARCO, for example, where ASARCO was basically the only corporation left standing after more than a century of mining activity in an important mining district in the northern part of the state of Idaho called the Coeur d'Alene Valley. And so the government attempted to extract potentially as much as $500 million from ASARCO to clean up this site. Well, of course, if that were to happen, ASARCO would be bankrupted many times over, so that they would never really be able to do it. There's not that much money to collect from ASARCO, but anticipating that risk, ASARCO has, during the time the case has been in the courts, carefully restructured its corporation through foreign subsidiaries to, in effect, move its assets offshore so that when the time comes that the penalty is finally given a numerical magnitude, ASARCO won't be much of a company anymore. It'll be a shell. Now, that looks like reprehensible behavior, but considering how tyrannical the law is, I find nothing for which I can fault this corporation. It didn't create this pollution, actually. Others did, hundreds of others, and those are gone. The individuals are dead, or the companies that operated there have liquidated long ago. There are no corporate assets to use, and so this law is simply a mockery. However, this law has not only supported many lawyers, but it's supported many experts, such as myself, who have worked as expert witnesses, many of them scientists, but others, like myself, engaged in historical and legal analysis. I personally believe, Richard Stroop, who's perhaps one of the best experts on Superfund, also believes that Superfund has been a complete failure. It's been a waste. Very few sites have been cleaned up. Very little positive result has come. When cleanup has taken place, it's involved huge costs, in addition to the costs of all the legal proceedings. Because the EPA takes measures that are senseless very often. Around the town of Aspen, which is a famous ski area in Colorado, was a Superfund site, and eventually the EPA decided that there would be a cleanup, and they assessed the cost to the remaining corporations they could find, and what they insisted in doing was scraping up about 1 foot of earth on top of a large area near this town of Aspen and hauling it away in trucks to a big dump site where they would dump it out again and then cover it with some protective covering. The upshot of this was that deposits, which may have been to some extent containing toxic materials, but were disturbing no one because they were well settled and had been there for a long time, they were disturbed and dispersed by being hauled in open trucks through the town of Aspen. Meanwhile, virtually every person who lived anywhere near Aspen screamed in objection to this project, but the local people's desires or wishes or the fact that none of them felt threatened by leaving these materials as they had been, none of that mattered, because the EPA is the great central planner in Washington, D.C., and when it imposed a cleanup plan, then the people of Aspen be damned. And Aspen is just one case in which that exact thing has happened. It was also done in the Coeur d'Alene Valley, where I worked, in the town of Kellogg, where they took 1 foot of soil from all the house surroundings in the entire town and hauled it into the mountains and dumped it into a ravine and covered it with clay. But to what purpose? There was no showing ever that any human beings there were being harmed by the deposits that remained. So, to sum up, U.S. environmental policy has given rise to many senseless actions, many costly actions, many actions that do not achieve the ends that they are supposed to serve. And for that reason, the authors in Rethinking Green are very concerned that there are better ways to protect the environment and to suggest what those ways may be. One thing they all bear in mind is that individuals have their own incentives and constraints. And unless the policy is compatible with the individual actor's own incentives and constraints, it will fail, because they will not comply as they are expected to comply. They will pursue their own ends, not the ends of some EPA lawyer in Washington, D.C.
All right. Thank you, Professor Hicks. I understand you don't know what the articles are about, so you are now free to ask any question, and if Professor Hicks is able and willing to answer, he will do his best to do so. So anything regarding environmental policy, economics, questions which bothers you, you don't know the answer, you can ask now. Okay, before the first one comes, I would like to ask myself, as I don't know how many of you saw Professor Hicks on TV, but I would like to ask whether you see any role for state regulations in environmental policy, as there are two articles, one of Roy Cordato, who is arguing that it should be free market based environmental solution to issues, and then PJ Hill, who is coming up with the probably most often heard argument of high transaction costs in environment, which is, as he argues, different from other areas, and he's saying that's the reason why there is sphere for government to help.
Well, I can conceive of situations in which some form of government regulation might be the best alternative I could think of. But what usually happens in an open market is that the way the market works, the way voluntary efforts that people make and the arrangements they make with one another are created and operated is something that no one imagined beforehand. So the fact that I myself or any scholar cannot say exactly how a voluntary arrangement would work does not mean that none is workable. We never know where the market will go until we leave people free to create their own lives for themselves. Now, what P.J. Hill argues in the exchange, or the kind of debate that Teresa mentions, is that the best role for government is not a regulatory role, but government should create property rights where they do not exist now. And once property rights have been created by the government, then private parties and voluntary organizations and efforts can, using those rights, make arrangements among themselves that are economically sensible, arrangements that do not sacrifice a greater value for the achievement of a lesser value. We know from general economic theory that rational allocation of resources requires prices, and it requires property in order for market prices to form. The same is true when we're talking about environmental goods. We must have some property in order for any kind of pricing to take place. Now, sometimes property rights exist already, but they are deficient in some way. They are property rights government created in the past with some other purpose in mind. They may be incomplete. They may not cover all the aspects of property that people now value. For a long time in the United States, trees were a nuisance. That's just something that North America was covered with, and people wanted to get rid of them so that they could not only use the wood for all kinds of purposes, but get them out of the way so they could make farms. Well, eventually, we reached a position in our development where many people valued a standing force just for their own sake. They were willing to have land retained as undisturbed forest. And if they really valued that use of land, they would be willing to pay for landowners to keep their land undisturbed. And often what has happened in the U.S. Environmental policy is that people did not believe this. They did not believe that private land ownership would result in preservation of forests, for example. And beginning in the 1890s, more than a century ago, much land was set aside in the United States in forest reserves. We now call them national forests, and they cover large areas of the western part of the United States. And those are managed by the Forest Service, a federal government agency. Well, the way the Forest Service actually manages the national forests is atrocious. It's the worst of all possible worlds. Because the Forest Service has become a kind of conspirator with logging companies, it has allowed logging companies to come onto the land and harvest trees. That's all right. Everybody expected that some trees would be harvested. But it's allowed them to harvest the trees in certain ways that are very destructive of other parts of the land's value. And the Forest Service itself has become the biggest road builder in the United States. These national forests are like spider webs of logging roads that the Forest Service bulldozers have gouged out of the mountainsides, so that logging trucks can go along and get in with their equipment and get out with the wood they harvest. And so many roads have been built in the national forest that it's created erosion of soil into the streams, which is bad for fish life. It's bad for sportsmen. It's created a situation in which people who value the forest for anything but logging have seen the forest despoiled. And furthermore, it's been done in such a way that even the logging is inefficient. I had a colleague years ago when I taught at the University of Washington who was an expert in forest management, and he calculated that the government's management of the national forests yielded a net negative stream of income. That is to say, any reasonable calculation of the holding cost of this enormous property worth billions of dollars the holding cost was greater than all forms of income or value being created by the management of the forests. It was just an asset that was creating loss year after year after year, when it could have been producing great net benefits of all kinds, depending on what people valued as a use of the national forest. Nowadays, of course, we're a rich society, and many people would like to use some parts of that forest just for recreation. They would like to keep some of it completely unused. Well and good. If that's the highest evaluation people place on it, that's how it should be used. And that's how a private owner would use it, because he would stand to gain by using it in a way that had the greatest value to consumers. But the government does not have a bottom line. It doesn't have to worry about the fact that it loses money on management of the forest, because it makes up the difference from the public treasury. It's continually subsidized to misuse this great resource. So it's just another example of how people's suspicion of what the market might do created a far worse situation than a market ever would have created. This is not just one professor's idea. We have a comparison that's important in the United States, because in the southeastern part of the United States, in the area where I live, there are no national forests, and the land was almost all privatized. So there are great forest lands there, but they belong to individuals who keep them because they like land with forests, or companies that produce wood for commercial sale. But in either case, the forests are well cared for, they're used efficiently, they're managed properly, they're not despoiled, there are no roads built where they shouldn't be built. The wood is cut at the proper time when it has the greatest market value. And in countless other ways, the southeast forests flourish. And those forests harbor, by the way, many, many, many members of endangered species that have a place to live because private owners maintain those forests as they do. In the West, where the government manages the lands, endangered species are in much greater danger.
Thank you. All right, you've got one question there.
I'm not sure if this is really bothering me, as you said, but I was wondering, as you talked about the 1973 Endangered Species Act, do you think a case could be made that the endangered species are actually worse off with that act rather than if there was no such act at all? Because if not, then it's easy for the friends of regulation, the friends of this act, to say, well, we're actually at least trying. What do you do?
I think the plants and animals would be much better off had there never been an Endangered Species Act. For one thing, many of the species listed are not really endangered. Indeed, many are not even species. One of the best examples of the latter problem is the so-called northern spotted owl. This owl was an enormous celebrated cause of environmentalists in the Northwest, and I lived in the Northwest for most of my adult life in the Seattle area. And for a century, that had been a great lumber-producing area. It originally was completely covered, or nearly completely covered, with beautiful forests of cedars and pines and firs and tremendous trees. And as a result of the spotted owl, the northern spotted owl controversy, the logging industry has been almost completely eliminated in the states of Oregon and Washington. That's an area, probably bigger than France, those two states together. Giant area of prime forest land no longer being used for wood production because people thought you have to have old growth forests. That's the only place this species can survive. If you've cut the forest down at some point in the past and replanted it, the owl won't like that. He'll die instead of live in a tree that's replanted 50 years ago. That is nonsense because in fact if you frighten a spotted owl out of an old tree, he will fly into the nearest tree without asking for its license. And secondly, this northern spotted owl is identical to a spotted owl that lives in the Rocky Mountains all the way from Colorado into Mexico. There is no genetic difference whatsoever. But the species that's geographically isolated in the states of Washington and Oregon, under the law, can be treated as if it is a distinct species, even though it's simply a distinct population of a larger population of the same species. So this whole dispute, with all of its consequences and its fierce politics, should never have happened. It's based on a mistaken understanding of the species people are arguing about.
Is there any other question? Yes,
maybe
please.
I have one. Can you tell me, or do you know, how big is public support of these legislative acts that should save the environment in the USA?
The support is enormous. The environmental movement has very wide public support in the United States. And that's not very surprising because in some sense we all value a good quality environment. No one wants to live amidst a blighted environment. No one wants to live in a toxic waste dump. But at the same time, most of the general public that supports these legislative actions has no real understanding of their content or operation or how they've operated in the past. And the environmental organizations are very good at public relations. One example of that discussed in the book is not an example in the United States, but an example in Africa of the ban on ivory trading that was imposed there some years ago. Many people recognized that such a ban would be a very bad policy in Africa, and indeed it has been a very bad policy because it made ivory a non-commercial commodity. The first thing that happened, of course, since there is a worldwide demand for ivory, is a black market grew up with poachers operating all over Africa. All of those governments where the elephants live are weak governments, unable to police and monitor their territories very well, frequently subject to easy bribery or payoff by poachers, often themselves the poachers, so that the black market price of ivory shot up after the ban was placed, and the result was poachers operated destroying many elephants all over East Africa and South Africa. In addition to that, the native people, I've spent some time in Kenya, and I can tell you the native people hate elephants. they would love to see them become a dead species because elephants are a great menace to them. These huge creatures may come through and ruin large areas of land that they're using for agricultural purposes. They may destroy houses very easily. So native Africans dislike elephants and have no particular desire to preserve them, simply to preserve them, but what they do have is an incentive to profit from them. And so in some places, private enterprise has been devoted to protecting elephants and protecting herds so that Americans or Europeans can go there as hunters. And elephants will be selected for harvest. The hunters will have the pleasure of shooting an elephant and bringing their trophy back to their palace. And the Africans will charge large amounts of money for their efforts. So this is turning elephants into something more like cows, a domestic animal to which people have a property right. They can exclude intruders. They have a good incentive to exclude intruders and to keep poachers away, to work hard at it, unlike the government guards and soldiers that now pretend to protect these reserves. And those private enterprises and elephants have been enormously successful. But still, they would be even more successful if ivory were, again, a commercial product.
Yes, please.
In today's Czech Republic, the green tax reform is a big thing politically. I'm just curious, how do you see as an economist this afford to use taxes and subsidies to manipulate private opting into becoming some closer to the so-called social opting?
Well, the fundamental problem with that approach is that it it requires what Hayek called the pretense of knowledge. It requires that we imagine that those people who set the taxes and determine how high they will be and where they will be applied have a godlike understanding of the operation of the economy so that they know how much tax to put and where to put it. In order to bring what we call the economy, this enormous complex body of human relationships, into a more optimal configuration. But the truth is no one has this knowledge. The economists who sometimes in the mainstream economics profession suppose that they have this knowledge are fakers, in my judgment. What they do is a scientific looking exercise, but it has no real foundation. I think that that's the basic problem, but it's certainly not the only one. Once a tax subsidy system is created, then everybody games the system to try to put himself in a position to penalize his competitors with taxes or benefit himself with subsidies in various ways. In the United States, by the way, many corporations support environmental regulations because they have made the decision that they can benefit themselves from the way the regulations operate to bear more heavily on their competitors than on them, or sometimes to create a market for goods they produce and sell. When the EPA makes every power station install scrubbers, this elaborate, very expensive equipment on its smokestacks, some corporations are manufacturing those scrubbers. The more the merrier, they believe. They would like every smokestack in the world to have a scrubber. So they, of course, will support that kind of legislation. Recently, some of the big multinational petroleum companies have begun to jockey relative to the Kyoto protocols to try to put them in a position to benefit. And I had an article in my journal also by Bruce Yandel specifically about how corporations will try to game the environmental regulations for their own benefit. So they become important political actors, important partly because they are often actors with a lot of money who can hire good public relations people and who have the ear of members of Congress and members of the bureaucracies. So when you involve players like that, it's no longer just people who love the woods versus corporate despoilers. It becomes almost a battle of corporate behemoth against corporate behemoth. And it's more like the usual politics, as I said. Politics as usual, not effective environmental policy.
Actually, I have lots of questions. So if there is no question from the audience, you just mentioned Bruce Yandel, who
yes.
is an expert who also wrote a paper on environmental Kuznets curve,
yes.
which is an instrument often used by free market environmentalists, showing that the environmental degradation is growing only to a certain point, mm-hmm. and when the wealth is growing, well, there are two axes, wealth, which is described by income per capita or GDP per capita, and environmental degradation on the other axis. And the shape of the curve is as such. And it says that as the wealth grows, the environmental degradation starts to decline at a certain point. There are also opponents saying that the reason why the degradation decreases is because of governmental regulations. Mm-hmm. What would be your opinion on that?
Well, I'm not sure that Yandel would dispute that. He may say that is one of the reasons why the environmental Kuznets curve has the shape that it has, that when people get wealthy enough, then they're willing to make sacrifices in order to pay the costs of environmental regulation to improve the quality of the environment. So he's actually written a number of papers that have some relationship to this theme. Sometimes they're not entirely private efforts that are producing the observed effect. They are various public efforts, sometimes cooperative efforts, among cities, for example, or among managers of drainage districts for river basins. So there are many ways in which existing government authorities may operate more sensibly to bring about some improvement in the environment. No one claims, to my knowledge, that nothing good has ever come of environmental regulation. Everyone recognizes that some benefits have been achieved, but the question is more at what cost? Given that we have achieved benefits, how much have we sacrificed as part of the process of getting those benefits? And even where government regulation has had visible physical benefits, we can measure in some gas concentration or some particulate concentration in the physical environment, we still need to know what that improvement was worth to the people who got the benefit from it.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Question to the book. Is there a part in the book focusing on global warming problems, or is it just about the U.S., what changed the policy of mm-hmm. U.S., especially the Bush administration? Because before it was against kind of the Kyoto, and now it's mm-hmm. kind of tending to agree and try to proceed.
The I'm just checking myself here because Bruce Yandel has several articles here, and some of them we included in the book, and some we didn't. He does have one chapter here. It's chapter 5 in the book called After Kyoto, A Global Scramble for Advantage. And it deals with this kind of corporate competition I was mentioning, but it also has to do with the politics that emerges from that. It's not specifically about changes in the Bush administration's position. I think it's usually fair to assume that their changes reflect the wishes of their coalition, which is not a very big one, really. They have many supporters who support them for reasons of sentiment, but the serious supporters, the ones that really put up the money for their re-election, are the ones they serve first of all.
So you can say now they want the Kyoto Protocol to be applied?
I don't think they want the Kyoto Protocol to be applied. They don't want the U.S. to become a signatory, but they may have found some benefit from changing the kind of speeches they make. It may be a public relations effort. Many of the noises politicians make are strictly for effect.
Yes, please.
Do you think that those public relations efforts are strong enough that the U.S. would sign it?
My own view is that considering U.S. politics as a whole, I don't think the U.S. is likely to sign the Kyoto Protocols, certainly no time soon. I don't know what may happen 10 years from now. Many things can change. Certainly, if Hillary Clinton is elected president in 2 years, then that will have an effect. But who knows? I'm just a humble economist, not a prophet.
All right. If there are no questions, I would like to thank Professor Hicks for being with us here today. And I would like to inform you about one more event which is coming. It is April 27th, when there is going to be a book launch of Björn Lomborg's book, Skeptical Environmentalist, translated into Czech, Skeptický ekolog, which was co-published by Liberální Institute. It's going to be in Clementinum, Mirror Hall, starting at 2:30, about 1 hour long event. And the speakers are going to be Josef Šíma from Liberální Institute, Bedřich Moldán, and Mr. Cílek. So everybody is welcome to attend and have occasion to buy the book of Björn Lomborg. So thank you for coming. Thank you, Professor Hicks, one more time for spending evening with us. Now you can have your cakes.
Well, I'm just putting them in the pockets.